One Detroit reporter once referred in print to our next guest as the most influential person in Michigan you never heard of. Since the 1960s, Lansing-based attorney Richard McClellan's imprint is found on a wide range of Michigan policy, from education to the judiciary to telecommunications, energy, and other fields. The Republican has also been active nationally and internationally for close to 40 years in West African affairs. There, he's been especially involved in infrastructure development and the often turbulent politics of the region. He's also a graduate of Michigan State University and has been an adjunct professor here at MSU. Richard McClellan, welcome to Current State.
Morning, Mark.
You began your working life in the Capitol building, you told me, in 1963 as a janitor. Pretty modest beginnings for someone who went on to become, as some people put it at the time, the Darth Vader of the John Engler administration.
That is accurate. All those are accurate.
Talk about this trajectory from janitor to policy heavyweight.
I was a janitor in 1963 in the House. They were kind of political plums, and through a complicated story involving former President McPherson of MSU, who was a janitor in the Senate, I got a janitor job. Then in 65, I got a summer job as a driver for then Lieutenant Governor Milliken. And then in 66, I got involved again during the campaign. 69, when Governor Milliken became governor, I went on his policy staff for 4 years.
Okay.
And then I just continued basically I moved across the street, opened a law office, and focused on public policy for the next 40 years.
I'm not sure anyone knew until this moment that Peter McPherson was a janitor at the state capitol, too. So,
yes, he was.
So those were political plums, as
yes,
you put
they
it.
Were.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your politics were already formed as a young guy, or did rubbing shoulders with William Milliken? And did you know George Romney?
Yes, I knew George Romney. I knew Soapy Williams. I knew John Swainson, Governor Swainson.
Okay.
Was a friend of my father's. I was, 1960, I was a Republican. In my town, Paw Paw, Michigan, I remember they had a teacher that had a little donkey pin on her, and I said, "What's that for?" And she says, "Well, I'm a Democrat." And I said, "Well, I thought to myself, well, I think it's okay to be a Democrat, but I didn't think they should let them teach in schools." It shows you the kind of community I came from. My grandmother said she'd vote for the devil if he was on the Republican ticket. So my roots were clear, but I've always been sort of a libertarian Republican for pretty much my whole political life.
Interesting. You've been working on education issues for the Snyder administration for some time. Tell us about the focus of your work there.
Well, Governor Snyder, when he took over in 2011, issued a message on education where he called about reinventing public education and breaking the status quo and allowing money to follow the child rather than being locked into the school districts. It was quite dramatic. And then he eventually asked me to rewrite the School Aid Act to accommodate those new public policies. And that's what I've been doing for over a year now. And actually, I'm going to meet over with his staff this week, and we've been moving ahead on that. I also was asked to get involved in the Detroit Public Schools issue and the creation of the Education Achievement Authority and a number of things. So I really, the last 2 years, I've been quite heavily involved as a volunteer helping the governor on this education policy.
What's that been like? I mean, go a little deeper here with us, if you would.
Well, one thing I learned is that the public education system is a very heavily regulated industry. It employs over 300,000 people in the state. It's very rigid. It's based on a 1920s factory model, is the way our education system is created. Kind of school I went to, maybe you went to too. And to change it is very difficult because it is very resistant to change. And having been assigned by the governor to address change, it has caused quite a bit of consternation among the existing school system. And so the governor really has to make some choices. He this month has his education summit where I think some of these issues will come out. I've been just doing basically volunteer staff work, but because of my unsavory background in the voucher issue, it's caused a lot of controversy.
Is there a scenario then where you would support either limited or full vouchers?
If in terms of my present assignment, I'm only working on the governor's policies.
Okay.
And there's nothing involved. Number one, it's constitutionally prohibited. Number three, it's been voted on by the people four times in the state with wider and wider margins. I think the voters of the state do not believe that their taxpayer dollars should go to pay for religious schools. It's just one of those fundamental things that I think a majority of the people oppose. Even though vouchers for private schools is developing all over the country as a way to try to address these failing schools, particularly urban schools. But it's not part of the governor's agenda. It's not part of my agenda. And I don't think it's really a relevant issue in the state of Michigan. It keeps being brought up by some of the education people, I think just as a straw man to beat up, because they don't want any change. And so the voucher is the most toxic word you can raise within the public education industry.
Hot button word.
It's a hot button word, and therefore if you throw it out, it gets people worked up.
You are, what do you make of the actual arguments against vouchers, though?
The interesting thing is many of the people that are for vouchers, I don't think they realize what it would actually do. It would bring with it some government regulation. You cannot spend public money without having a regulation. I think a lot of these private school people have an idea that they'll just get free money. That's the way it's going to work. They're already regulated, the religious schools and private schools. So I think there's some real limitations to it. Now, I happen to believe that probably giving more people more options is a reasonable approach, but it's not the only approach. And therefore, it's been rejected because I think fundamentally two reasons. One is there is a general non-support for use of public money, taxpayer money in religious institutions. And secondly, the industry, the school industry, doesn't want competition.
Okay. You're the author of the state's charter school law. What do you make of the way the public school academy movement has taken hold here in Michigan?
It's only about 10% of the students. Some of the schools are terrific schools. And some of them are pretty awful. And I think that this is one area where the charter school people have not really stepped up and shut down bad schools, which was the original model. Governor Engler was very clear when he created charter schools that they were to be experimental, that they were to, some would work and some wouldn't work. But once you create a school, there suddenly becomes, whether it's a traditional public school, as they're called, or a charter school. People want to keep it open, even if it's not working very well. I think we have to do a better job of shutting down bad schools generally.
What makes the good charters good, and what makes the bad charters bad, from your experience?
Security and safety, and the environment, to a large degree. If you can have a, let's say you're talking about the traditional area where charter schools go, urban areas that have difficult environments. They're smaller, they're safer, they create a culture of learning, sometimes better, not always better, but sometimes better than the traditional school model. And I think that's, and then it takes leadership, good teachers, a curriculum that is appropriate for that community. There's all these elements that I think you can identify that make a good school, whether it's a, quote, traditional school or a charter public school, or for that matter, a private school.
Mm-hmm.
Charter schools are just one flavor of public schools. It's a government-run school, quite heavily regulated.
There is ongoing suspicion of charter schools related simply to the profit motive. How concerned, how vigilant should the public be about this? And is that suspicion? How justified is that suspicion?
Well, to me, it's not a question of profit. It's a matter of, are they delivering the services they're provided? Nobody goes after General Motors for making a profit and selling school buses, or Apple selling iPads. The private sector services are the way we deliver a large part of the services to public education, from electricity and insurance and school buses and lawyer services and school textbooks and uniforms and all kinds of things. Now, we expect our public school authorities to manage those. So the charter schools are authorized and overseen by generally state public university boards. And when they do their job, you don't have to worry about the management company. You do have some problems, I think, of weak boards that have a management company that may be too strong. It's like any public service. We need to make sure the public manages its public resources.
You mentioned the Education Achievement Authority earlier. Do you support the expansion of the EAA?
I support the governor's effort to address the question of these underachieving schools. Don't forget, the EAA, in part, is to carry out the functions of the school code amendments that were adopted under Governor Granholm and a Democratic House of Representatives. It's not a partisan issue, but it's a fear on the education establishment, even when they have failing schools that have failed for 30 years sometimes a school. So it's to take over not more than 50 schools, I believe, is the latest version, and to try to impose new teaching techniques, new management, new structures. So the EAA is one tool that the governor created, and I was pleased to help him to put it together to try to address these. Because at the time we created it, the Detroit Public Schools was about to completely implode. And we have schools all over the state. The real challenge is everybody wants to talk about Detroit. But there's some really failing schools that are failing students all over the state.
What about the now people who resist the expansion of the EAA claim it simply it's only been in operation since September. Shouldn't we wait for more results to be sure this is the
think about an elementary school. If you don't get the students to read by the third, fourth grade, they never learn. This very interesting part, one of the main arguments of the industry is you can't do anything because it's untested and you can't start it and test. And so if you read their rhetoric, this is one of the major arguments. Look, the education establishment has been around for a long, long time, and they have a whole series of arguments to stop change. It's experimental, it hasn't been tested, it doesn't treat everybody, it's unfair. And so we have experimented with schools. Don't forget, charter schools, we exactly the same argument against charter schools. We can't do that, they've never been tried. How can we test them if we don't do it? Mm-hmm. And so that's just one of the arguments that it's not without some validity. It's untested. Well, I'll tell you, the people running the EAA have a lot of experience, are some really outstanding educators that understand urban schools and urban kids, and they use computer-assisted learning. There's some very exciting ideas in the EAA, and most people, if they went down and visited it and saw it, they would find out what the facts. If you just listen to the rhetoric of the lobbyists, you don't get any real honest picture of it. I'm not sure the EAA has had the resources to tell their own story, but they have a great story. I have met with them, and they're really trying to do a great job they got the worst of the worst schools in Detroit to try to turn around, and they're having some success, they're having some challenges. They just replaced two superintendents or principals this week. So, but I think it's the governor's got, he's willing to take on very tough issues like that.
We're talking with Richard McClellan here this morning on Current State on WKAR. How important is it that more revenue be invested in education in general? In the state? Is it important for that figure to go up?
You know, we're going to face a declining enrollment for the next 20 years. And if we continue to decline enrollment and keep spending more money.
We know they're declining enrollment for two decades?
We are going to, for the next 20 years, we're going to have declining enrollment in the public schools of Michigan.
How do...
Demographically. Okay. We're getting older smaller, poorer, and dumber in Michigan. There's a lot of things going on that are going to keep on happening. Everybody knows that. These school superintendents that really in the 60s, 70s, 80s were successful because they built institutions. They built large public schools. They really were skilled at getting property tax. They're now in the business of managing decline, and it's very difficult. We have way too many school districts, and they have a very hard time shutting schools, laying people off, and cutting some of the overhead. So it's a challenge that the existing school districts have, and I think that's why they're so threatened by charter schools, unbundling, online learning. Every one of those things is seen to a threat to a school district that is already facing dramatic challenges.
Let's change the focus here just a little bit. Yeah. You've spent some time monitoring elections in other countries. Tell us a little bit about that experience. Where have you done that, and what's it been like?
In 1990, I received a phone call, and I said, would I go to Bulgaria for President Bush to see the election? And I said, sure, where is Bulgaria? Well, the next day, I flew off to spend a week in Bulgaria with five or six of us, and we went all over the country meeting with political parties. The Bulgarian government was one of the most slavish devotees of the Soviet Union, but had made a decision to go to the West. They removed their dictator. The Communist Party said, we're going to move to the West. We're going to have a real election. I was fortunate to participate in that. And so that was 1990. 1996, I went back for the presidential election in Bulgaria and saw the changes that can happen in a very short period of time. Bulgaria is now part of NATO. It's part of the European Union. It's dramatically changed. Doesn't mean it doesn't have problems. All those countries have problems. But some people, don't forget, young people today don't even remember the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any idea what that meant. The Iron Curtain and what went on behind the Iron Curtain. So to be part of that was one thing. I also have been, as I think you mentioned, I go to West Africa a lot. And Colin Powell headed up a delegation to one of the Nigerian elections. So I went to Nigeria and spent a week as an official observer of a Nigerian election. I also was involved in representing the transitional government of Somalia, not because they had elections, but they had the United Nations had propped up a government, and I was involved in doing some things not over there, but back here for them.
Does your experience lead you to be encouraged about the expansion of democracy in transitional parts of the world, we'll call them?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful not to be try to impose the American multi-party model. It works a lot of places if it can take place. Clearly, there are some areas where it's one time, one man, one vote, one time. And that we've seen that in some areas where perhaps the Islamists take over. Iran is a good example. They sort of have elections, but only as approved. So, but yes, you're getting some surprising developments of democracy. Look at Myanmar. Really has been moving away by choice. You get other places like Libya. I don't know. Are we going to be able to have any kind of democracy there?
Yeah. What are your thoughts in general about the Arab Spring and the aftermath of the Arab Spring?
Well, I was over in Jordan a couple of years ago, and I spent a lot of time there, and I've talked to people. That's a very risky area. If King Abdullah falls in Jordan, it's going to have some significance. But they're right in the middle of everything, Syria, Iraq, and Israel. I'm going to Israel again this year, take another to go back again. I've only been there once. I think the Arab Spring is only part of this whole movement of Islam. You may still see a war between the Shias and the Sunnis. Clearly, Egypt hasn't been working very well. They're practically bankrupt. So every day there's some new challenge that we face. I would not want to be in the State Department Middle East group. They're going to be busy in the next few years.
There's a good deal of soul searching in the GOP right now in the aftermath of Mitt Romney's loss. Is the party in need of an overhaul?
Yes, it is. I mean, I'm similar to the libertarian, conservative. I'm very conservative, but I'm much less willing to impose my views on other people. I have pretty conservative views, but I just don't believe you impose. So there is no question in my mind, say, 10 years from now, people my age will have kind of died off and say same-sex marriage is not going to be an issue in this country. And it doesn't mean that people of deeply held religious views will necessarily support it, but the law will permit it. We will recognize other people have different views. Race is still a problem with the Republican Party. There's still some ugliness in both parties. Race is a serious problem. I'm a big fan of immigration for a conservative reason. I believe the economy. We need more talented workers here. Mm-hmm. We don't want to end up like Japan or Europe where we're getting old. We need young people. So the Republicans, from my perspective, they're going to get their act together and change. We've gone through these various periods. I was involved in the campaign with George 43, and they made this gay marriage a very big issue on the campaign because it worked that year. It's amazing how things have changed.
It is incredible.
And if Republicans are going to try to run that kind of campaign again, they're out of date.
How do you think history will regard Rick Snyder's first term?
Well, I think if they step back, I've been around 40 years, I've looked at governors, I'll say this guy in the first year or two did some amazing things in terms of public policy. I mean, as much as people grumble about it, the point is taxing pensions was a critical public policy. And he's just getting pilloried by Republicans and Democrats. But if you've got to have a rational public policy, as we get older and older, if you have a large number of people that don't pay any taxes. So he did some things that aren't very well known and they aren't very popular. He's also been willing to take on some of these education issues. I think 10 years from now, right to work or freedom to work, as we Republicans call it, will be nobody will ever try to undo it. It's going to happen. There's so few people in the state now that are part of organized labor. And most of my organized labor, I've always known the lobbyists and so on, and we've argued for years. But the truth is they have a disproportionate influence on the public policy of the state than they do on the economy. They do not represent a significant part of the private sector. They do have a huge impact on the public employee section.
Okay, we have to let it go there. I'm sorry to say. Richard McClellan's been our guest here on the first half of Current State. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'd like to have you back.
Be happy to come back. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
You.